Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
As Secretary Blinken embarks on this fifth trip to the Middle East, what we need to be watching for is how much Arab and Israeli officials take him seriously. The Biden administration hasn't been able to negotiate an end to the war or even a pathway to ending the wars.
Secretary of State Tony Blinken is back in the Middle East as Israel threatens to launch a ground invasion of Rafah, where over half of all residents of Gaza have sought refuge. While the United States has rejected calls for a permanent ceasefire, Blinken is pushing for a new truce and hostage deal. We'll speak to HuffPost's Akbar Shahid Ahmad. Then we speak to an American doctor who recently returned from Gaza.
What really gets me is not the ones who are, you know, dead on arrival, unfortunately, because there's nothing maybe that could have been done for them except to stop the bombing. But it's the ones that we could have saved. It's that 15-year-old that, had he just gotten to the operating room quick enough, you know, had we not been completely overwhelmed with an overflow of 500 patients in the ER overnight.
We'll speak to Dr. Seema Jalani and air recordings she made from inside Al-Aqsa Hospital, one of the last functioning hospitals in central Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. As Gazans brace for an expected Israeli ground invasion of Rafah, unrelenting attacks across the besieged territory continue as the death toll tops 27,500 people, with another 67,000 wounded after nearly 4 months of daily attacks. Israeli strikes hit residential areas, elementary schools, hospitals, and aid distribution sites all within recent days. The Palestine Red Crescent Society published footage Monday showing its Jabalia headquarters in northern Gaza heavily destroyed after Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, an UNRWA food convoy was attacked by Israeli artillery fire Monday. This is Juliette Touma, communications director for the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency.
It was not the first time an UNRWA convoy with the United Nations was attacked. It's the third time a convoy belonging to UNRWA has been exposed to an attack on its way to the north of Gaza or when it is coming back from the north. And this is not acceptable. Humanitarian convoys, according to international humanitarian law, must be protected from all parties to the conflict, also during combat.
The UN has appointed a panel to independently review Israeli allegations that a handful of UNRWA staff were involved in Hamas's October 7th attacks. The panel's findings are expected to be released in late March. The U.S. and a dozen other countries have already halted funding for the life-saving agency. Nearly the entire population of Gaza is displaced and reliant on aid. This is Aisha Abu Al-Khair, a mother displaced from Gaza City.
In 2024, we're dreaming of living our lives. People move forward and live their lives. We are still chasing a plate of food and bread for our children to survive. We ask of the President of the United States to help the people of Gaza send aid. He can see the situation here in Gaza and how difficult life is and how children are lacking food and water. Instead of helping Israel with rockets and bombardments, he should help the people of Gaza and look at how much the people are struggling to get a plate of food or a loaf of bread.
Meanwhile, a new report by Amnesty International says Israel's army has been carrying out unlawful killings of civilians in the occupied West Bank and should be investigated for possible war crimes. Amnesty says Israeli forces have displayed, quote, a chilling disregard for Palestinian lives as a wave of brutal violence in the West Bank has intensified since Israel began its assault on Gaza. Amnesty investigated four separate cases of violence, including an Israeli raid on Nur Shams refugee camp in Tulkarm that began October 19th and went on for at least 30 hours as Israeli forces stormed dozens of homes, cut off water and electricity to the camp, destroyed infrastructure with bulldozers, and blocked two ambulances from reaching injured residents. At least 13 people, including six children, were killed in the raid. Since October 7th, at least 360 people have been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank, including 94 children, according to the UN. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is meeting with leaders in Egypt and Qatar today on his second day of a Middle East tour as a possible new Gaza truce and hostage handover inches forward amid rising regional tensions. Blinken met with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia Monday and will also travel for meetings in Israel and the West Bank. U.S. officials say Blinken's trip is aiming to ease tensions in the Middle East, where the U.S. is supporting Israel's catastrophic war on Gaza, and U.S. military forces have struck Yemen, Iraq, and Syria in recent weeks. This comes as Yemen's Houthi forces say they fired more missiles at two U.S. and U.K.-owned vessels in the Red Sea. The Houthi movement said such attacks will continue, quote, until the siege is lifted and the aggression against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip is stopped. Meanwhile, France's new foreign minister, Stéphane Séjourné, used his first official visit to Israel on Monday to urge Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to allow an immediate ceasefire and a massive influx of humanitarian aid to Gaza. Séjourné also met with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas Monday, where he called for an end to Israeli settler violence. Nicaragua could move to take Germany, Canada, the UK, and the Netherlands to the International Court of Justice over their role in aiding Israel's genocide in Gaza. Nicaragua called on the four nations to immediately stop providing arms, munitions, and technology to the Israeli army. Meanwhile, South Africa's Minister of International Relations, Naledi Pandor, says she questioned why International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan issued an arrest warrant against Russian President Vladimir Putin over his actions in Ukraine, but not for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Pandor visited the ICC offices while in The Hague for the ICJ ruling on South Africa's genocide case against Israel. Prosecutor Khan was not able to answer the question. Back in the U.S., hundreds of Pennsylvanians rallied at the state capitol in Harrisburg Monday to demand the state divest millions from Israel bonds. The protest was led by Jewish Voice for Peace, the Philly-Palestine Coalition, and the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE. Police arrested at least 126 demonstrators. State Representative Chris Robb attempted to shield protesters from arrest and later defended their right to protest, evoking the history of the civil rights struggle and Black History Month.
All the things we talk about during Black History Month or Martin Luther King Day, oh, and all the great things that happened, all of those things were far more than inconvenient. They were radical. They were radical. This is a radical expression of one's First Amendment rights. In the people's house, this is the most ironic place to arrest people for expressing their First Amendment rights.
A new report by The Guardian has exposed a growing internal rift at CNN over its one-sided coverage of Israel's war on Gaza and the, quote, censoring of Palestinian perspectives. CNN's Atlanta headquarters issues editorial directives for the entire network, relying on official Israeli accounts. In addition, all content must be approved by the Jerusalem Bureau. This comes amid outrage over recent inflammatory headlines in mainstream newspapers in the U.S. On Friday, The Wall Street Journal published an op-ed titled, "Welcome to Dearborn, America's Jihad Capital." In response, Dearborn's mayor, Abdullah Hamoud, said he was ramping up police presence across religious sites and landmarks over fears of racist violence. President Biden and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer both condemned the article. Meanwhile, longtime New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman penned an op-ed titled "Understanding the Middle East Through the Animal Kingdom," in which he compared Iran to a parasitoid wasp, writing, quote, "We have no counter-strategy that safely and efficiently kills the wasp without setting fire to the whole jungle," Friedman wrote. Michigan Congress member and the only Palestinian-American U.S. lawmaker, Rashida Tlaib, said, quote, "This is blatant Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism that puts people's lives in danger," she said. In Texas, a man attacked four young Muslim Americans who were driving home from a protest for Palestinian rights in Austin on Sunday. Three of the victims are Palestinian Americans, including a 23-year-old who was stabbed after the attacker pulled them out of the car. They say the suspect, who's been identified as Bert James Baker, yelled obscenities, including the N-word, and tried to rip off a keffiyeh hanging from the car. The Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, is calling on authorities to charge Baker with hate crimes, saying, quote, "Those responsible for this violence must be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, and those fomenting the anti-Palestinian and anti-Muslim hate that leads to this violence must be condemned." Senegalese lawmakers voted to delay presidential elections until December 15th, following President Macky Sall's announcement Saturday postponing the vote, which had been scheduled for later this month. Chaos overtook the parliament as opposition lawmakers attempted to block the vote in protest.
Je mets au voix. Quels sont ceux qui sont pour? 104. Quels sont ceux qui sont contre?
This is not possible. They're stealing from the population of Senegal.
Security forces forcibly removed some lawmakers during the session. The election postponement by President Sall, who's already served the maximum two terms allowed, was followed by street protests and accusations of a constitutional coup by his opposition. Rights groups warn Senegal's democracy and political stability are at stake. In Sudan, a new report by Doctors Without Borders warns at least one child dies every 2 hours in a camp for displaced people in North Darfur as fighting between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces enters its ninth month. The humanitarian aid group estimates that about 13 children die each day in the Zamzam camp, one of the largest sites for internally displaced people in Sudan, where MSF is the sole health provider. Children who are suffering from severe malnutrition are expected to die within a few weeks unless they receive urgent care. This comes as the World Food Program says many people are dying of starvation as hunger has doubled in Sudan over the past year due to the ongoing violence that has cut off civilians from life-saving aid. Some 18 million people across Sudan are facing acute hunger, while nearly 11 million have been displaced from their homes. Back in the U.S., the Poor People's Campaign launched a 40-week operation to catalyze the voting power of poor people across the country. Some 7,000 volunteers will be tasked with mobilizing 15 million voters ahead of November's election, with the first major coordinated actions taking place outside 30 state houses on March 2nd. This is Bishop William Barber unveiling the initiative at a press conference in Washington, D.C. on Monday.
For far too long, extremists have blamed poor people and low-wage people for their plight, while moderates too often have ignored poor people, appealing instead to the so-called middle class. Meanwhile, poor and low-income, low-wage people have become nearly half of this country, and we are here today to make one thing clear. Poor and low-wage brothers and sisters have the power to determine and decide the 2024 elections and elections beyond.
And millions of people gathered across Turkey today to commemorate 1 year since a devastating earthquake and its aftershocks killed over 50,000 people. In Antakya, the capital of Hatay, the worst-hit southern province, crowds held a moment of silence at 4:17 in the morning local time, marking the moment the quake struck. Protests broke out as residents continued to demand justice and accountability from authorities for poorly regulated constructions and for delays in responding to the disaster, which left many to die, trapped in the rubble amid freezing temperatures. Others gathered in Malatya to mourn the dead.
I lost my children, I lost my daughter, son-in-law, my three grandchildren. It feels like I'm living the same days again. Only their memories are left, their photos, their love is what is left. They are my children, what can I say? It is just difficult.
The 7.8 earthquake and aftershocks killed some 6,000 people in northern Syria, worsening an already dire humanitarian crisis after over a decade of conflict. Many who lost their homes are still sleeping in tents. This is a Syrian man who lost his home and remains unhoused along with his neighbor.
He has nothing now. He is staying in this tent and has nothing. His situation is really bad. No one asked about him, nor came to check. He's staying in the tent here. God help him and everyone. We are all staying in tents after a year of the earthquake. What can we do?
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Secretary of State Tony Blinken is back in the Middle East as Israel threatens to launch a ground invasion of Rafah, where over half of all residents of Gaza have sought refuge. The U.S. has rejected calls for a permanent ceasefire, and Blinken is pushing for a new truce and hostage deal. We'll speak to Huffington Post's Akbar Shahid Ahmed. جواسيسك انت شريفك عملوا لك دقة وزار تتقصع فيه المومس والقارح والمنظر جواسيسك انت شريفك عملوا لك دقة وزار تتقصع فيه المومس والقارح والمنظر والشيخ شمهور شراكف عالكود يا وهات يا مواكب والشيخ شمهور شراكف عالكود يا وهات يا مواكب وبقيت Nixon Baba, performed by Mariam Saleh and Zaid Hamdan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh, joined by Amy Goodman. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Nermeen, and welcome to all our listeners and our viewers around the country and around the world. Well, I'm not a novid anymore. For 4 years, I somehow avoided getting COVID, but I ended up getting it. Asymptomatic, I'm at the tail end of it. I just have to go from positive to negative. It's not exactly in my nature to go negative, but I'm really working on it. Until then, Nermeen's there and I'm here. And most importantly, on with the show.
We really look forward to having you back, Amy. Secretary of State Tony Blinken is heading to Qatar and then to Israel and the West Bank after holding talks in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. This comes as Israel threatens to launch a ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where over half of all residents of Gaza have sought refuge. Palestinian health officials say Israeli attacks killed 107 Palestinians over the past day, bringing the Palestinian death toll to over 27,500, including over 11,500 children. This is Blinken's fifth trip to the Middle East since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. The State Department says Blinken is pushing for a pause to Israel's assault and for Hamas to release all remaining hostages seized nearly 4 months ago. On Monday, Blinken met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Riyadh, where they discussed a potential deal involving Saudi Arabia normalizing relations with Israel in exchange for Israel agreeing to a pathway for a Palestinian state. Saudi Arabia is also seeking a new military pact with the United States and U.S. assistance with its nuclear program. This comes as Hamas is reportedly reviewing a truce and hostage deal negotiated in part by mediators from Egypt and Qatar. Blinken's trip comes just days after the United States bombed 85 targets in Syria and Iraq in retaliation for a recent drone strike by Iran-backed militants on a base in Jordan that killed 3 U.S. troops. The U.S. has also repeatedly bombed Yemen over the past 2 weeks, targeting sites controlled by Houthi forces who've been targeting ships linked to Israel and the United States to protest Israel's assault on Gaza. We begin today's show with Akbar Shahid Ahmad, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Akbar. We are very happy to have you here. If you could first respond, tell us what's most important about the meetings that Blinken had already with the Crown Prince and his meetings today in Egypt. What's at stake?
Thanks for having me, Nermeen. Secretary Blinken is hoping that Arab officials will finally believe the U.S. is serious about an end to the carnage in Gaza. It's a hard ask because a lot of Arab diplomats, a lot of regional diplomats who are worried about the spiraling conflict feel the Biden administration has no real interest in pressuring Israel to stop. And you've got repeated comments from Israeli officials, most recently Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu just yesterday, saying, we want to see Hamas leaders killed. We want to see months more of war, if not a year. And ideas for a resettlement of Gaza, extremely controversial proposals. So Blinken, on the one hand, is dealing with Israelis who are not saying what Arab diplomats and the U.S. want to hear. He's representing a president who has a policy of near total support for Israel, and he's getting flack from Arab diplomats. Blinken is, of course, a skilled foreign policy official, a skilled mediator, but it's a very hard task for him, Nermeen, because there's not a lot of goodwill or faith right now for the U.S.
Akbar, if you can talk more about what you think took place before the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and Blinken, and the significance of what exactly Saudi Arabia, the United States, and Israel are proposing. The Hamas attack on October 7th took place just around the time that Saudi Arabia was going to normalize relations with Israel. Talk about what that would mean and exactly what these proposals are and how possible you think they are.
Absolutely, Amy. So prior to the October 7th attack, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Israel were talking about this kind of tripartite deal that would involve the Saudis giving Israel recognition from Saudi Arabia, which is a huge win for Israel, right? After many years of conflict, feeling threatened by its Arab neighbors, this would be the biggest, most important Muslim-majority country in the world, essentially saying, we recognize Israel. And importantly, without Israel having to make significant concessions on the Palestinian file. So that's where this whole process, while it's been beneficial for the U.S., for Saudi, for Israel, the Palestinians and their advocates have been saying, where are we in this conversation? So prior to October 7th, there was already huge anxiety about these talks. There was dissatisfaction. And then the attacks happened. And, you know, no one less than President Biden has said they see that U.S.-Israel-Saudi process as part of the reason for the October 7th attacks, right? It was a way, in part, for Palestinians to kind of bring this issue back on the negotiating table. However, since then, what we've seen 4 months into this war is that rather than considering, well, maybe this approach got us to conflict, the Biden administration has doubled down on the U.S.-Saudi-Israel deal. So they've taken the Gaza war and they've tied it to what they were doing before the Gaza war. Their new proposal is, we'll rebuild Gaza using Saudi money. This will be part of the whole package that will get the Israelis to make some significant concessions to Palestinians. It'll get the Saudis to have the American commitments they want. But in terms of the feasibility, it's quite, I'd say at best, contentious, right? U.S. officials I talked to within the government, one described this as, quote, delusionally optimistic. You've got so many parties involved. You do not have a serious commitment from the U.S. to get Palestine anything major, right, beyond economic guarantees or the reconstruction of Gaza. And then you've got what you referenced earlier, Nermeen, the strikes by Iran-backed militias. There are a lot of what's called spoilers, a lot of other forces around the region who don't like this deal, who certainly see the deal, especially between Saudi, Israel, and the U.S., opponents of Iran, as very risky for Iran and its network. So in terms of the actual feasibility of something being approved, I'm skeptical. And it's important to remember there's a very short runway now prior to the election. And if the Biden administration wants to get a security treaty with Saudi Arabia through the Senate while they still have control of the Senate, I mean, they've only got 6 months to do it.
And then can you talk about what's happening today with Tony Blinken in Cairo and Qatar before going to Israel and then the occupied West Bank?
Absolutely. So the Egyptians and the Qataris are critical mediators because the U.S. does not speak directly to Hamas, which the U.S. lists as a terror organization. So any messages from the U.S. have to go through Qatar and Egypt. And Israel also doesn't really like directly dealing with Hamas. So Blinken is in Cairo, and he was in Doha, kind of hoping to get those governments to pressure Hamas. Now the yes is on Hamas's side. Israel has kind of tacitly agreed to a truce and hostage release. But the longer there's a delay here, the more it seems that this deal isn't achieving what the Palestinians or Hamas might really want, right? So you've seen Prime Minister Netanyahu come out and say, I want to kill Hamas leadership. That raises the stakes for Hamas if they're saying, why would we agree to a two-week deal if after that you're just going to come back, invade Rafah, kill our leadership? So I think the prospects of a deal to me seem low right now. Some of the other important sticking points are, of course, there's broad agreement that the hostages, particularly civilians, particularly older people and children, should be released. That's kind of generally agreed upon. But the question is, how many Palestinian political prisoners is Israel willing to release in return? There's a certain Palestinian leader called Marwan Barghouti, really seen as a unifying Palestinian figure. And Hamas has said they want him out of jail. Now, for a lot of Israelis who don't want to see a kind of unified Palestinian movement, that's a no-go. So there are a lot of sticking points here, and it's up to Secretary Blinken to kind of push everyone towards a median. I think the Qataris can certainly play a very helpful role here with Hamas, but that any indication of U.S. seriousness is what's needed, and we haven't yet had that, certainly not from President Biden.
And Akbar, I mean, as you said, the issue of the release of Palestinian prisoners is something that Netanyahu, at least, has ruled out, as well as the creation of a Palestinian state. So it's unclear how, you know, these positions can be reconciled because there's no incentive for Hamas to go along with this. But I wanted to ask, I mean, Saudi Arabia is also pushing minimally for the minimal condition of the creation of a Palestinian state. But where do other Arab states stand? Including Egypt and Qatar, who are the negotiators, as you said, the mediators. Where else do Arab states stand on this? And is it important at all?
It's critical. I love how you phrase it, Narmeen, because the Saudis certainly want us to think they are pushing for the creation of a Palestinian state. But their language is sort of shifting, right? Sometimes they say creating a Palestinian state. Sometimes they say a pathway towards a Palestinian state, or irreversible steps. So that goalpost is shifting all the time. And I think for the Saudis in particular, who have, especially under Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, really expressed disdain for the Palestinian cause in recent years and the sense that it's been a burden for the Arab world and a deep enthusiasm for relations with Israel. For the Saudis, I'd say kind of limited Palestinian concessions would be acceptable, if they can get some kind of Palestinian window dressing of approval. And I've heard from my sources that there are quiet conversations going on between the Saudis and maybe some friendly Palestinians who might be willing to bless whatever the Saudis can get. In terms of other states, Qatar is one of the firmest in terms of wanting to see a resolution here. I think for a lot of states that maybe were not taking the strongest position earlier, so think about the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Arab countries that have made deals with Israel. I think after this war and after the spiraling tensions, right, the risk of a huge Middle East war, those countries are feeling more and more, we need a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that is meaningful. For Egypt, I think that desire is there, particularly because of the strikes you mentioned by the Houthi movement in Yemen. Shipping is not going through the Suez Canal as much, and for Egypt, that's an economic lifeline, right? So they want the war over, so the Houthis stop attacking shipping. At the same time, it's really critical to remember, is Egypt helped Israel with its blockade of Gaza, right, for the last 16 years. Egypt has not, for years, wanted to see a strong, independent Palestinian presence. So I think they'll be weighing that quite cautiously, and they won't necessarily be such firm advocates for serious Palestinian statehood.
And Akbar, you've written extensively. At the moment, we see Netanyahu being singled out as the person who is responsible for the present situation. He certainly hasn't made it any easier and arguably, of course, much more brutal. Although, as you point out, it's important to look at the long-term context in Israel and, in particular, U.S. support for Israeli policies, whatever form they've taken. So if you could elaborate on that and what distinctions you see between Netanyahu and his predecessors on the question of Gaza.
Absolutely. So Netanyahu is an easy bogeyman from a U.S. political standpoint. You're already seeing Democrats who are kind of scrambling to defend President Biden's policy here. They're saying, well, it's not really about Biden, it's about Netanyahu. And given that Netanyahu was so close to former President Trump, opposed President Barack Obama so vocally, for Democratic voters, yes, Netanyahu is an easy bogeyman, but absolutely we have to look at the context. And for the first 3 years of the Biden administration, two of those years, they did not have a prime minister, Netanyahu. They had a